I think we all know and realize we have Thanksgiving weekend and it was beautiful. We, as God's people, know that our ultimate goal, our ultimate destination is to be actually a member in God's family. Now, that is a tremendous goal and something that we ought to keep our eyes on all of the time. I want to turn to Revelation 21 and verse 4, and I want to read that verse. I'll probably make you sick and tired of it before I'm done today. Maybe I will. I mean, if you ever get sick of that verse. That's one of my all-time favorite verses, I might say. I really do like that verse. Revelation 21 and verse 4. And God will wipe away every tear from their eyes. Think about that. Can you even imagine a time like that? You know, there's nothing in this whole life or world that we live in that, where you can even imagine that sort of thing. And it won't be that way. You see, when this transpires, this will be after mankind is all finished as far as his relationship as a physical man. And this then will be in God's family. This is awesome when you think of it in that light. He'll wipe away all tears from their eyes, and there shall be no more death. No more death. Now, of course, I'm 85 years old, a little closer to it than most of you, hopefully, as far as that part is concerned, but there won't be any more death. Not just the people, I believe, from what that says to me. There has been death of all of the creatures that God has ever created all the way down through the history of life, can I put it that way, on the face of the earth. I don't know how this all came about, obviously, but it seems to me that God made man in his own image. And in doing so, then, you can figure out at least how God thinks a little bit, even though it's so much higher that we can't even remotely scratch the surface. But we know the kind of thinking, that's all I'm trying to describe. And when man built an automobile, boy, that first one was a pretty crude machine. And what is this like the ones we have out here in the parking lot now? How did that develop? Well, it came through a long, 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 long process of improving and developing of various things along the way. As far as I am concerned, I think that's what God did in a similar sense, even though I don't even remotely understand how. But God didn't just create man, the ultimate of his creation, to develop, to become a part of his family ultimately. He didn't create that man without knowing pretty well ahead of time what he was going to do in terms of animated beings. And there's been life and death, all kinds of it, many of it that we don't even know or understand anything about. We know that there was a dinosaur age, and we can talk about that, and we find skeletons of dinosaurs and stuff like that. And we know that they lived and died and were gone, and there were obviously all kinds of creatures that were created, and it doesn't stretch my mind any to think that God was actually experimenting, shall I say, I'll hopefully use that in a right way, experimenting for the ultimate plan down here that he knows he's going to develop eventually, but he wanted to make sure that it was going to work out. I don't know. I don't know if that makes sense to you. It makes a lot of sense to me that God planned mankind, and when he finally created him in his own image, he already pretty well knew what animated beings were going to do and how they were going to live and exist and carry on and breathe his air and eat his food and so forth, to do all of those things. But How did that come out of Revelation 21 and verse 4? There will be no more death. There will be no more death. Well, then no more animals are going to die either, apparently. No one needed it. See, animals are made for man, let's face it. And I know we have people today that practically worship animals and so forth. Now, I don't exactly worship animals, but I'm very thankful. See, when I grew up, boy, that was our life. We had horsepower, literally. We had about 12 head of horses that were good work horses, and we had about 3 spans of 4 head teams that we could line up on a 400-acre farm back there when I was a little tiny boy. And that was all the power we had. There wasn't no tractors or anything like that back in those days. That is, that we had, anyhow. There were some crude tractors, but we didn't have anything like that. They came along a little later in my lifetime, too. But animals were for man. We had a dairy farm, and that was our life, really. That was our support of life. I don't like to see animals mistreated, but they're just animals to me, because we had no problem at all butchering a calf and eating it, you know. Could be ever so friendly out in the little lot, all of that sort of thing, but they were just animals to us. Altogether different feeling towards animals, and I know I have that to this day, and even a lot of you don't look at it in the same way that I do. I'm very well aware of that, but that doesn't mean that I want to be bad to animals at all, God forbid, but I surely don't worship them. Can I put it that way? They're just animals. They were made for man. Where did God get the clothing for Adam and Eve when they were in the Garden of Eden? From skins. Where do skins come from? Obviously from animals. And I don't know how God did that, but that makes sense to me that it had to be. Now, animals are for man, and that's fine, and there won't be any death. And thank God there won't be any mosquitoes buzzing around. They'll all be dead. But it says there will be no more death, and nor sorrow. Boy, now, does that touch you or not? Can you imagine, living in a whole society, if you please, the family of God, and not a glimmer of sorrow? That stretches my imagination, really. Because we have so many things. This is Satan's world, and Satan sees to it that there's always room for sorrow in Satan's world. And so there is nothing in this world that you can compare that to, a time of no sorrow whatsoever. But that is what God says is going to be in His family ultimately. No sorrow, and nor crying. There won't be any reason for crying, thank God. No reason whatsoever. For the former thing, nor shall there be any more pain. Now, you see me limp on that right hip all the time, and I've been limping on that hip for what? Since 1992, I guess. I'm just thankful that that's all I have as far as the difficulties are concerned, you might say. My basic health is good, and I'm very grateful to God for that. But there won't be any pain. No pain, that's what it says. No pain. Think of that. Now, when you get up at older age, you probably have a little bit better feeling for that than you did when you were younger. But even when you were younger, you still had pain. And I used to kid my children all the time, and my children loved me very dearly, of course, but when they would bang their hand on something or hit their hand with a hammer or do something to hurt themselves, they'd come crying, and they'd come up to me, and I would usually look at them, and of course they knew probably ahead of time whether I was going to do this already, but they still loved it all the time. I would look at them and I'd say, "I thought I told you not to be hurting Connie." And then they'd start laughing. See, the pain was pretty well gone by then, and a lot of it was just the fact that it hurt them at the time they did it, and by that time it had worn off anyway, and so they were all happy again. But we had pain anyway. even when we were young. But there won't be any pain. That's what it says there. No pain. And for the former things have passed away. Mr. Moody gave a tremendous sermon last week. I thought it was very good. I had to compliment him on that, on trials and why we have trials and so forth, and got into that subject in a very tremendous way. I thought he did an excellent job of that. But my question is then, what's to be the end result of that, those trials? Revelation 21 and verse 4. Why is God making sure that you will fit that particular category of Revelation 21 and verse 4? In order for you to fit that, we have to change from the condition we're in now to match that. And as far as I'm concerned, that isn't an easy task. Because I know I wasn't converted, and I was baptized when I was 35 years old. I'm sorry, pretty hardened in the ways of this world even before that. Now, I didn't just come out of school and learn all of this and become a part of God's truth that way as a young person. And a lot of you had to go through the process of being called after you were a little bit older too. And know the process I'm talking about. You know that you have to go through quite a process of conversion, and a big process of conversion to ever get over to Revelation 21 and verse 4. Think about that, of the very reason then for the trials that we had in this life and have in this life all the way along. I'd talk about that today, because I think it would be appropriate for us to think about the awesomeness of thanksgiving that we're to have with God ultimately when we get into His family. I say when we get into His family. I told everybody down in Texas when I moved away from there, I said, I want to see every one of you in God's kingdom. Now that means two things. First off, it means I'm going to get there. But it means another thing. It means you're going to get there too. Then we can see each other in God's kingdom. And we will all be in this condition where we will be, we'll fit Revelation 21 and verse 4. There'll be no sorrow and no death and no pain and no difficulties. We won't have that, because all of that will be past. And as a result of the trials that we have along the way, God can finally make sure that we fit that category well enough to take us out of this life. Can I put it that way? Maybe that's why I'm pretty healthy yet. I've got a long ways to go. But I certainly do appreciate that opportunity that God gives us. The Apostle Paul said he told the Philippians he hadn't yet attained to that level. But when he wrote to Timothy, finally in 2 Timothy, he told him that he had now, was ready to be sacrificed, because he knew he was apparently sentenced to be death already by that time. I'm not sure about that, but that seems to be the case anyway. And he made it. But it was the same Apostle Paul that said, follow me as I follow Christ. Follow my example. And it was the same Apostle Paul that wrote Romans, the 7th chapter, where he said he had problems too, you know. What I would do, I would not, and what I would not, that I do. And I'm torn with all of this stuff. In Satan's world, that's the way it is. We've grown up with all of these various habits and ways of living, and the Apostle Paul was no exception. He just was in a little different set of circumstances, a little different environment in his day. I want to turn to Hebrews, the 11th chapter, and I turn to just one verse at this time because of what I just said. Why do we do it all? We know that Hebrews 11 is the faith chapter, and it gives example after example after example after example of those that had faith and stuck it out, so to speak, and did it. In verse 35, I just want to read that one verse, Hebrews 11 and verse 35. Women received their dead raised to life again. Others were tortured, not accepting deliverance, that they might obtain what? A better resurrection. A better life. A better way. They knew that they had to be tested and tried in this life, as Mr. Moody brought out so vigorously last week, and I thought it was tremendous, brought out where even some Christians were tarred and put oil on them and lighted the oil and burned them as torches. All of us have had burns of some kind, surely. You know that a burn is about the most painful thing there is. How could Christians do that? Well, let me ask it this way. How could God allow them to do that, to be tortured that way? I tell you that it was for a trial. I don't know how many of you have ever read Fox's Book of Martyrs, but in that, I've been a long time since I've read it too, but in that there is an example of where Christians were literally tied to stakes, fires built under them, and they were burned up, and they died with smiles on their faces. I thought about that, and I thought about that, and I said, that in all I know in the whole world in which I live, that's impossible. But nothing is impossible with God. And I gave the example in Sedgwick, and I'll give it here. I don't have it in my notes. I had an opportunity to... We had a member of the church that wanted to be anointed. I went over and anointed him and asked him the problem that he had. Well, the man had been a man that was out in the orange groves. This is back in the late 50s, I believe, or early 60s. I'm not sure. Somewhere back in there. And they never even wore a mask back in those days. And they sprayed all of these horrible chemicals on the orange groves. And he went out there and sprayed this. And he did it for years. And his whole respiratory system was just choked up with cancer. And he asked me to come over and anoint him when it got so bad. And he was dying, to be frank about it. And I told him that he ought to go to a doctor just to see what was the matter. You know, get a diagnosis at least of some kind to find out what the trouble was. Oh, he wasn't going to go to no doctors. Nobody went to any doctors back in those days. And I said, I would if it were me, just to see. You don't have to take the medicines if you don't want to. That's up to you. Or you don't have to take their treatments, but at least you'd know what's the matter. Well, okay, he says, do you know a doctor I can go to? I said, well, yeah, I happen to know a Seventh-day Adventist doctor that I think would be pretty congenial about that sort of thing. If you want to go. Well, if you'll take me there, he says, I'll go. I took him, and the doctor took one look at him and knew almost instantly that after having all of that stuff in his system for so many years, what was wrong. But he took a biopsy anyway, and told us to come back, I think it was the following Tuesday or something like that, when he got the results of the biopsy. And he called me over and he says, what am I going to tell this man? He had a name this long that didn't make sense to me. And I said, well, doctor, you're out of my category on that, those fancy names. I said, you got to have to tell it to me straight. He said, well, he's got cancer throughout his whole system. That made it straight. And the doctor says, well, what am I going to tell him? And I said, doctor, why did he come here? He came here to ask you what was wrong. You got to tell him. Oh, if I'd have taken a glass of water and thrown it in that doctor's face, it wouldn't hurt him any worse, I don't think. He almost stomped into his office after I said that. sat down in his chair, and I went in and sat down in the chair beside this man when he was there. And he looked over his desk. I'll never forget it. Looked over his desk right at that man, and he said, "You've got cancer throughout your whole system, your whole body." And he says, "And you won't even let me give you anything to ease the pain or do anything about it." The man just stood up and he says, "Thank you, doctor. That's what I came for." Turned around and walked out. I'll never forget it, because he was dying. And there was no question about it. Now, I mention this about this man for a very important reason. I visited that man. We had to put this man in under surveillance 24 hours a day with some of our members. Back in those days, it wasn't unusual for us to do that. And every day I went to visit this gentleman. And the odor from that cancer was so bad that you could hardly walk in the house at that stage, because he was dying, and there's no doubt about that. But I anointed him. And after that anointing, every day I would walk in to see him. He had a big smile on his face, and he says, "I feel great. I don't have any problem, no pain whatsoever." Is God able to take away the pain? There's no doubt in my mind, I'll assure you of that, because I saw it right under my own hand, that is, right before my own eyes, with this man. He lived, and it just happened that one of the members that we had out at that time had been a former sheriff's deputy for a number of years, 15 years, I believe. He was the man that was sitting with this gentleman that night when finally the cancer ate through his jugular vein and he just dumped all of his blood right out, just one big gush. And this sheriff's deputy, this former sheriff's deputy was there, and of course he knew what to do. He just grabbed the telephone and called the sheriff's department, and who should come out but one of his friends that he knew in the sheriff's department for all the time, and wouldn't know what was going on here. You always have to have an investigation. And incidentally, I hope all of you know that if you ever have an incident where somebody drops dead at home, and you don't call anybody except the police right off. First thing, always, always, always call the police first. I've had so many experiences like that in times gone by. I could talk about that, but I won't. But always call the police first. Well, he called the sheriff's department, and he came out and investigating. He said, "Well, it's obvious, you know, there's no problem here as far as his dying is concerned, but how long has it been since he'd been to a doctor?" Well, in California, the rule was at that time that if they had seen a doctor within 10 days, then they wouldn't have to have, there wouldn't be any more problem as far as that was concerned. Well, it just happened that this was the 10th day after he had walked out of that doctor's office. And so he was within the bounds of that time when he died. Now, I saw him every day, and he had no more pain. He didn't have any pain. With all of that, body just eaten up with cancer. And incidentally, unfortunately, I've had to have the experience of seeing people that did have a lot of pain with cancer, too, in my many, many years, almost 50 years of counseling with people. 48 years, so I better back it off a little. But God is able to intervene wherever the circumstances can be. Now, I read this verse 35, that they might obtain a better resurrection. To see the ultimate goal, they were willing to go through whatever it took. And they did. I think it's good for us to realize that is the very purpose for trials that we have to have along the way. You know, We had a good sermon on that, but I said that the one thing about that I wanted to point out is that the ultimate purpose for all of that is what it's all about, really. Why do we have those trials and tests along the way? Well, it's for God to make absolutely sure that there'll never be a mistake in any of you, because God made all of us different. None of us are alike, identically. Everybody is unique as far as individuals are concerned. And so God wants to know you uniquely, how sure He can be that you will never turn away, never turn back on anything of these things that are mentioned in Revelation 21. No sorrow, no pain, no death, nothing of this nature. Will there be no sorrow whatsoever? Well, how will God know that unless He tries you in those very things that would be temptations for you to, where you would be tempted to give up? God has to know, and He is going to know, or we won't be there. I feel comfortable about that personally. 1 Peter, the 4th chapter. I want to turn to that. 1 Peter 4. And I'll start verse 1. 1 Peter chapter 4 and verse 1. Where it says, "Therefore, since Christ suffered for us in the flesh, arm yourselves also with the same mind." Become of that same mind. You know, Philippians 2 and verse 5 says, "Let this mind be in you, which was also in Christ." Yes, we need to have that same approach then. Have that same mind. For he who has suffered in the flesh has ceased from sin. Now, that ceased from sin is maybe a lot bigger than what we would like to see right off the top. He not only ceased from sin, but He made our possible release from the wages of sin for every human being that will actually benefit from all of that and fill that position of going through the necessary trials to prove irrefutably that they'll fit that category of Revelation 21 and verse 4. I said I'd rub that sore for you, and I probably will before. But now, verse 2, 1 Peter 4 and verse 2, that he no longer should live the rest of his time in the flesh for the lust of men, but for the will of God. You see, none of us should live for the will of men any longer. I lived a lot of years that way myself before God ever turned me around, and it isn't easy to turn around from all of that, I can assure you. Verse 3, for we have spent enough of the past lifetime in doing the will of the Gentiles, or the non-godly ones. God called the Israelites, and we'd say the non-Israelites. Actually, should probably translate it the nations. During the will of the nations, when we walked in lewdness, lusts, drunkenness, revelries, drinking parties, and abominable idolatries. I don't like to read that because I don't mean to say that I was illegal and went outside the law and all of that. I did all of these things. I mean, I just have to admit that. I'm sorry. Before God ever called me out, I was into that kind of life, and I'm ashamed of it, but I can't change the fact. And to change that is not all that easy. That's the only reason I want to read it. And the Apostle Peter knew that when he wrote this. It says, in regard to these, they think it's strange that you do not run with them. You know, when you stop that, why, people that knew you all of the time think, now what happened to you? You've gone crazy, or something happened to you altogether. They think it's strange that you don't run with them anymore in the same flood of dissipation, speaking evil of you. They will give an account to him who is ready to judge the living and the dead. Yes, they will. I want to drop down to verse 12 because there it says, "Beloved, do not think it strange concerning the fiery trial which is to try you, as though some strange thing happened to you." Don't think it's strange when we have trials. You know, we're told to realize that James tells us to be joyful. I'm going to turn to that verse in a little while, but it says, "But rejoice to the extent," verse 13 says, "to the extent that you partake of Christ's sufferings, that when His glory is revealed, you may also be glad with exceeding joy. If you are reproached for the name of Christ, blessed are you." See, I grew up in a solidly Lutheran family. So solid in the Lutheran family that to this very day, when was it? Last week, wasn't it? I got some missive. Had the reference to the Lutheran church on it. They never turn you loose. You see, once you're in a Lutheran, you're always a Lutheran. That's the way it is, or they're concerned. Well, I haven't been to any Protestant church of any kind except to go to a funeral, but otherwise I haven't been to a Protestant church for so long that it's pathetic. But nevertheless, wherever I travel, and I have gone all over the United States in traveling, they always keep up with my address somehow. And they'll send me certain things from the Lutheran Church. Now, I mention that because that's about the way the world works with that sort of thing. They'll give an account, all right, but don't think it's strange concerning the fiery trials that come to try you, though they're a strange thing. But rejoice to the extent that you are partakers of Christ's sufferings. Now, verse 14 is what I was reading. If you are reproached for the name of Christ, blessed are you, for the Spirit of glory and of God rests upon you. My family thinks I'm crazy. My brother and sister-in-law came to visit me one time, after I'd been in the ministry for years, and I was a pastor at a church down in Texas at the time. And we had a nice visit as far as that goes. They were friendly with me and so forth. But when I'll never forget, when they got in the car and they drove off, I greeted them very warmly to tell them goodbye. And my sister-in-law stuck her finger right in my face. She said, "Yes, and Al, and you knew better." I'll never forget that. I looked over at my brother, and he just smiled and laughed. And didn't he wasn't... He knows me probably better than any other person on earth anyway, but that's the way they are, you see. Once you're a Lutheran, why, you know better. Well, I guess I didn't. They think I'm nuts. On their part, he is blasphemed, but on your part, he is glorified. Verse 15, "But let none of you suffer as a murderer, a thief, or an evildoer, or as a busybody in other people's matters." In other words, don't go out seeking revenge just because, "Well, I'll get you, you dirty so-and-so." You know, none of that. Never have that kind of a frame of mind and attitude. Now, I grew up with that. That's the way I grew up. Now, I don't mean to say that I was out trying to fight everybody that came along. I'm not saying that. But there was that frame of mind there that had to be changed from that attitude of revenge when somebody does something. "Yet if anyone suffers as Christ, let him not be ashamed, but let him glorify God in this matter. For the time has come for judgment to begin at the house of God." You are the house of God. That's where judgment begins. Judgment, discerning how you will face reality of the trials that you experience. Will you benefit from them so that you prove irrefutably to God that you will fit that category of Revelation 21 and verse 4, so that you'll be there in that family. It takes a lot of change for me, I'm sorry to say. But judgment begins at the house of God. And if it begins with us first, what will be the end of those who do not obey the gospel of God? Well, we have the privilege of knowing when they're going to be judged too, and they'll be justly judged. God will see to that. Just that they get that much more hardened into the ways of this world, and it's just that much harder to come out of. I know, because I had to come out of a bunch of it. I'm sorry to say. I know it's tough. Now, verse 18. Now, if the righteous one is scarcely saved, where will this ungodly and the sinner appear? Therefore, let those who suffer according to the will of God. Oh, you suffer according to the will of God? Commit their souls to Him in doing good as to a faithful Creator. I think it's good for us to take those words to heart, really, because we need to do that. I'm right here in the area. I'll turn to James, the first chapter. Just back up a few pages in my Bible. James chapter 1 and verse 2. My brethren, count it all joy when you fall into various temptations. If you understand the process of God going through, to see to it that you will ultimately fit that category of Revelation 21 and verse 4. Then we can count it joy, because we know what God is ascertaining by giving us the trials to see whether or not we'll make it. When you are faced with various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces patience. I tell you what, I came out of the army and I needed a lot of it. Boy, I got so sick of standing in lines that I could hardly stand to see a line anymore. And I needed a lot of patience, I'll assure you. You know, the army, you hurry up and wait. You run like crazy, and then there's a whole line of guys, and then you got to line up and line up and wait and wait and wait and wait and hurry up and wait. That was the expression that went everywhere. And I got so sick of that I needed a lot of patience, I'll assure you. Now, I don't mean that I have it all whipped together. Yeah, up to this day, but it's a lot better now, I'll assure you. But let patience have its perfect work. Let patience have its perfect work, to work to perfection. Revelation 21 and verse 4. I repeat it over and over. That you may be perfect and complete, lacking nothing. God will know for sure by the time you die, that you'll be ready for that or you won't be ready for that. And he knows for sure. I don't mean to say that we'll have every nuance of all of those things whipped either. I'm not trying to describe it that way. I'm trying to tell you that you must absolutely and irrefutably prove beyond any shadow of a doubt that you'll never turn away from God. Now, that's the faith that Abraham had, and we'll turn to that in a little while. But that's what is necessary about it all. That lacking nothing. If any of you lacks wisdom, let him ask of God, who gives it all liberally and without reproach. And it will be given to him. Now, I guess I don't know how many times I've had people say, well, now Solomon was the wisest man that was ever lived on this earth, wasn't it? Wasn't it? Yeah. He's the wisest man that ever lived. Well, then how about Jesus Christ? I've had people ask me. And I almost laugh in their face. Who is it that created everything that was created, and without anything, there was nothing created that was not created by him? That one, that Jesus Christ, that became Jesus Christ. Then you think Solomon was wiser than he? It's just a crazy thought when you think of it like that. No, Solomon was wise, yes, But Solomon was not wise enough to stick it out at the very end. He let women get to his problems, to become his problems. But if you any of you lack wisdom, let him ask of God, who gives liberally to and without reproach, and it will be given to him. But let him ask in faith, with no doubting. Now, if we have any doubts about it, well, then might as well not ask God at all. But he who doubts is like a wave in the sea, driven and tossed to and fro. For let him let not that man suppose that he will receive anything from God, from the Lord. For he's double-minded, unable to in all of his ways. Double-minded, like the Apostle Paul said, he found himself facing a certain time when he says, the things I would, I do not, and the things I would not, that I do, and do, and do, and do. You know, caught with these various temptations that come there. If you please, tests from God. I am quite satisfied the Apostle Paul made the test. And I have no doubts about that myself. But didn't mean he wasn't tested. He certainly was. And he faced horrible things many times. Let's go to Philippians, the fourth chapter. I want to go to that particularly. Philippians was a book that was written, you know, one of the prison epistles. The Apostle Paul was in prison. And the Philippian church was a relatively poor church. They didn't have communication like we have today, you know, everybody sitting and driving down the street with a cell phone to their ear and all that kind of stuff. I shouldn't mention that, I guess, but it is always annoying to me to see that. There are so many accidents. Well, Mr. Williams isn't here today, but that's what happened to him, you know, the lady that smashed into the back of his car when he was stopped for a school bus, of all crazy things. And this woman comes and slams right into the back of his car at 40, 50 miles an hour, and she was on her cell phone. She told me that, and I had to watch my attitude a little bit right about then. I could get a little bit annoyed about that. Philippians chapter 4, I think I want to start in verse 4 and here and read this. It says, rejoice in the Lord always. Again, I say rejoice. Let your gentleness be known to all men. Now, that word is an interesting word, gentleness. The margin in my Bible here has it graciousness or forbearance. Shall I simply say, the goodness of God shining through you. That's what your presence should show when you go out among the people. And it does. I think all of you have experienced that. I know I have at times when I just walk into a place and there's something happens. They say, who am I? I'm just like any other person, but there's a certain respect that's there instantly. I've experienced that. I experienced that when I was first converted, and it almost dumbfounded me, and I wondered what was going on. But it happens that your gentleness be known to all men. The Lord is at hand. You see, they recognize something about you when you have the Spirit of God in you. Be anxious for nothing. That is, don't get all upset about anything. Don't get overly anxious about anything that happens. Don't worry about that aspect of it. But in everything, by prayer and supplication with thanksgiving, let your requests be made known to God. And the peace of God, which surpasses all understanding, will guard your hearts and minds through Christ Jesus. They certainly will guard your minds. And he says then in verse 8, finally, brethren, whatever things are true, whatever things are noble, whatever things are just, whatever things are pure, whatever things are lovely, whatever things are of good report, and if there's any other virtue, And if there is anything praiseworthy, meditate on these things. They're godly things. That's the way our mind should work. That's what he's saying. These are the things to meditate on. The things which you learned and received and heard and saw in me, these do. When he stood before them, they saw him as an example to follow. And he said, follow me as I follow Christ. That was the same Apostle Paul that wrote the 7th chapter of Romans, where he said that the things I would, I do not, and the things that, he was torn by these things too. And he said, oh, wretched man that I am. I rejoiced in the Lord greatly that now, at last, your care for me has flourished again. Though you surely did care, but you lacked opportunity. You know, we don't know everything that goes on. God does, but the Philippian church was a rather poor church, and they didn't know the conditions that the Apostle Paul was in. When they found out about it, well, then they sent help to him. And not that he was crying out for that as far as he was concerned, but they didn't even know his circumstances, apparently, at the time. That's what it says to me, anyway. But he says in verse 11, Not that I speak in regard in need, for I have learned in whatever state I am to be content. Learned in whatever state I am to be content. If we have that kind of faith in God, then we can be content even if it's trying. We can be content. And the Apostle Paul was telling us this. He says, I know how to be abased, and I know how to abound. Yes, he knew how to be abased. I'll say he did. They took him out and stoned him and left him for dead one time. And he spent a day and a night right out in the water one time, and another time he spent how many? 14 days without any food whenever they were shipwrecked. He knew how to be abased, all right. And he says, I know how to abound. He was born to a relatively wealthy family. From his father was a merchant in Tarsus, apparently, and Tarsus was the city right up on the main line of all of the travel down into the Middle East, and so practically all of the merchants in the world came through there, and he probably learned more languages than we ever heard of as far as we were concerned, and he knew all of these things, and he had the capability to learn them. He says that he isn't abased, or he learned how to abound also. He knew how to do that because he was from a relatively well-to-do family. Everywhere and in all things, he says, I have learned both to be full and to be hungry, and to abound and to suffer need. He faced all of those trials. But then look at verse 13. I can do all things through Christ that strengthens me. We can't do it alone. If I can do anything, I want to leave it to Christ that strengthens me to do anything. That's the way the Apostle Paul was stated. He can do anything through Christ that strengthens me. Nevertheless, you have done well that you have shared in my distress. It was good for them. That's what he's telling them. It was good for you to be able to do that. I wanted to point that out, but I said earlier, how about Abraham? Abraham was told to get out of his country and go, and he just up and left. Abraham went to a far country where he didn't even know where he was going, apparently. I don't know if he did. They may have known the law a lot more than we know today, as far as that goes. Those people were brilliant in intelligence, so far ahead of all of us that there's no comparison. But I am convinced of that anyway. We have degenerated in intelligence clear down to our level, can I put it that way? That's about where we are, about the end of the line. Abraham was faithful to God. We read the faith chapter. We read Romans, the 4th chapter, about the faith of Abraham. Abraham was, all of those years, God promised him that he was going to be the father of many, many, many nations and peoples and tongues and languages and all. And yet he didn't have a son. He didn't have any children. And it went on and on and on. And you know what Abraham did. He had to have a child through his handmaid. And God says, nope, that's not the way I'm going to work it. And so he said, your wife is going to have a child. Well, she was way past the age of bearing children, 90 years of age. And then he finally had a son. And after that son got up to, what, about 12, 13 years of age, I don't know, somewhere in there, he said, take him out and sacrifice him. After all of those promises and all of that faithfulness, let's turn to that in Genesis, the 22nd chapter. I didn't go through the other things in detail. You can see where he was promised that through Isaac all the nations of the world would be blessed. And he had that promise. Genesis, the 22nd chapter. Now, verse 1, Genesis 20, chapter 22, and verse 1. Now it came to pass after these things that God tested Abraham. Wait a minute. He had been tested all the way, hadn't he? He went through test after test after test, did you think? Why would God have to test him now? After all of this that he had been through. God tested Abraham. See, Sarah was already dead. I believe that's correct here, isn't it? But anyway, no, I guess I'm ahead of that story. But anyhow, God tested Abram and said to him, Abraham, and he said, here I am. Verse 2, and he said, take now your son, your only son Isaac, whom you love, and go to the land of Moriah, and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains, of which I'll tell you. Now, what did Abraham do? Well, he arose in the morning and did it. He took off. Did Abraham have faith that God would accomplish what he said? He did it. He did it. He carried it on down. I'm not going to read all the verses in, but drop down to verse 9 where we see this. And they came to the place that God had told him. And Abraham built an altar there and placed the wood on the altar. And he bound Isaac, his son, and laid him on the altar upon the wood. And Abraham stretched out his hand and took the knife to slay his son. God told him to offer his son as an offering. He built the altar, put the wood on it, put his son on it, raised the knife to cut him up. And he was going to do it, obviously. But, verse 11, the angel of the Eternal called to him from heaven and saying, Abraham, Abraham. So he said, here I am. And he said, do not lay your hand on the lad or do anything to him. Why? For now I know. Finally. God says, if you'll go that far, now I know. Now I know absolutely that you fear God, since you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me. God knew then that Abraham trusted him. God made a promise. Abraham says he'll do it. God told him to sacrifice his son. Didn't take away the promise. God will still do it. That's what Abraham, that's the faith Abraham had. God made a promise that we should develop to the place where we fit the category of Revelation 21:4-2. God is going to do it, whether I ever make that category or not. God will do it. And I know that, irrefutably. Return to Hebrews. I told you I'd come back to Hebrews. Hebrews, the 11th chapter again. And Hebrews 11, and this time verse 17. By faith, Abraham, when he was tested. I read that where he was. God tested him back there in Genesis 22. When he was tested, offered up Isaac, and he who had received the promises offered up his only begotten son, of whom it was said, in Isaac, your seed, shall be called. Concluding that God was able, verse 19, concluding that God was able to raise him up even from the dead. God says he would do it. God told Abraham to offer him a sacrifice. Okay. He would offer him as a sacrifice because God would still do it. You think Abraham had faith in God would do it? Well, I believe that Abraham said that irrespective of what would come, God is big enough to take care of it. God can do it irrespective of what comes. And you see, by faith, for he said, in Isaac will your seed be called, and concluding that God was able to even raise him from the dead, from which he also received him as a figurative sense. You see, he wasn't able to have any more sons. That is, not by Sarah. That was a miraculous thing that he had a son by Sarah. And so, but God was able to even keep his promise irrespective of what he did. And he believed him. Now, that is faith. I hope and pray that I can have that kind of faith if trials come upon me, if God ever tests me to that point. I've been tested pretty severely on certain things anyhow, but I won't go into that now. But the irrespective of the nature of the test, can we do what Abraham said? Even if God has to raise him from the dead, he'll do it. That is awesome. I think it's fantastic. We can believe that God will do what he said. He's going to prepare a people. That was the last of his creation at the beginning. He created man the last day and created man such that he had put a spirit in him that was could apply or could uniformly join to God's spirit. And man then is in the not only the image of God, but of the God genus, if you please. God had a son by a woman. How you know, you can't cross genetic lines. You can't cross dogs and cats. And God has a law, a genetic law. Well, God had a son by a woman. Obviously, the woman had to be of God genus. No doubt about that. You are of God genus. God wants you to fit that category of Revelation 21 and verse 4. And when you do, God will have fulfilled his promise that he is going to have his family increased by all of those that really will comply and reach that category through the various trials and tests that we have in this life.